Thanks, folks. I'm super honored to be here. I'm really excited about this presentation because just in the past 2 or 3 months, some revolutionary discoveries have been made about fungi that I think will strike to the very core of your being, literally. So I am the messenger of a message that's far more important than the messenger. There's so much that needs to be done in such a short period of time. The good news is that these fungi are intelligent. They're quick to respond. They're our allies. They can set up ecosystems that can lead to sustainability. But I want to provide to you actionable, ecologically rational, economically sustainable, and paradigm-shifting discoveries that can make a real difference, not only for your lifetimes, but many generations into the future. So, I've done some TED Talks and things like that, and I have to compete with myself, you know. So my friends, well, that was great, that was interesting, but what are you doing now? I feel it's really important that I keep, you know, on top of the curve, on riding the mycelial wave. So I'm going to take you on a magical mushroom journey, literally. Hopefully this talk will not get me arrested. I've never been arrested yet. So I'm 62 years of age and I have no criminal record. Woohoo! But just a general question. I asked this at the MAPS conference. This is a safe question for you to answer, okay? Should the feds be here? So how many people here have not tripped on psilocybin mushrooms? Can you just raise your hand? Wow. For the record, there are no hands. 600 people here or so, there are no hands. So I brought a few of my fungal friends here. This one is called Reishi Ling Chi, the mushroom of immortality. It's one that I grew. It's a mushroom with a long, long history of use. And I'll be talking about this later on as well. And there's a mushroom that my hat is made from. And this is called Amadou. Amadou is known as Fomes Fomentarius. I'm going to use a few Latin binomials, but I'll try to always use the common names as well. This mushroom was revolutionary in its time for multiple reasons. There's no doubt that we all are Africans. Get over it, folks. We moved to Europe. We became white. But we are all Africans genetically. That's the birthplace of our species. And we moved north. We discovered something new called winter. Oops. And this mushroom allowed for the portability of fire. It's a tinder conch. You can hollow this mushroom out, put embers of a fire inside, and carry fire for days. You know, if your clan moving into the winter of Europe could not start fires, your clan likely would perish. And so this allowed for the portability of fire, absolutely important as a survival tool. Moreover, when you soak this mushroom in ash water from a fire, it delaminates into a fabric. And this fabric is not only highly flammable, but also this hat, which came from some ladies in Transylvania, have kept this tradition alive over thousands of years. So this cellular fabric is actually mushroom mycelium. The mushrooms are made of compacted filamentous fabric of cells called mycelium. And the mushroom delaminates. You can pull this apart and create a fabric. So this became the tinder conch. The famous Iceman had it with him. It was discovered 5,300 years ago. Interestingly, this also was used by fly fishermen to dry their flies. And it was also used, really interestingly, by beekeepers for smoking their hives. So this is what I think why mushrooms, plants, animals become shamanistically important, because of a plurality, a multiplicity of benefits. When you have your survival tools that have to be portable, they have to be, you know, they can't be heavy, and they have to be multiply useful for multiple applications. This is truly where mushrooms have made their mark in history. Not only this mushroom allowed for the portability of fire, but it revolutionized warfare, because in Napoleonic times, flint spark guns, even though the Chinese invented gunpowder, the Europeans invented the gun. And this enabled the flint spark to ignite the gunpowder. So in Napoleonic times, there's a massive trade of amadou, and which gave the advantage, of course, the people who had rifles to be able to win in combat. So I'm going to put these down. This is a piece of art that I commissioned. And some of the mushrooms, amadou, I guess you can't see it, this light, amadou on the left. There's the reishi mushrooms. Mushrooms I'll also be talking about. Our friendly psilocybes here. So I'll be talking about a number of these species. So hold on to your proverbial hat. This is going to be a very intensive download. Now, I am, you know, driven by science. I'm a science ambassador for the American Academy for the Advancement of Science. I was greatly honored because it was highly vetted. There's only seven of us appointed in the inaugural class. And I had to go through a gauntlet of peer review scientists, you know, and they were looking for cutting edge leading thinkers who are on the cusp of new innovations that could have a downstream impact. So I want to thank AAAS, as it's known. They published Science Magazine. Thomas Edison founded it. And my other invention ambassadors, you know, please check into AAAS Science Magazine. It's really, really cool group of women and men that are leading the edge of science. So my talk today is mycology and the mycology of consciousness. So most of you know about button mushrooms. This is a Agaricus brasiliensis. It's a almond portobello-like mushroom. But I'm really fascinated by how mushrooms decompose. Now, mushrooms are the tip of the proverbial iceberg. Mushrooms come up and disappear, as most of you know, in 4 or 5 days. So we have a long history of contact with plants and animals through the seasons. So familiarity brings you comfort in understanding what's in the natural landscape. But mushrooms that pop up and disappear in 4 or 5 days are so ephemeral. You know, some can feed you, some can kill you, some can heal you, some can get you high. And so when those mushrooms come up and disappear and they have such potent properties, only the cognoscente, the shamans, the earth magicians, the who had intimate contact with this eclectic group of organisms, you know, it's just a small body intellect of knowledge. It's amazing that we know as much as we do today. Because of that sudden appearance of mushrooms that are so powerful, it's naturally the fear of that which is unknown. And so this bred a lot of what we call mycophobia, the irrational fear of fungi. Now, in Eastern Europe, the French, the Russians, the Germans, they are mycophilic societies. But our medical knowledge, primarily coming from Britain, was the source of mycophobia, that mushrooms are sources of decomposition and death and destruction. Well, in Asia and elsewhere around the world, especially with indigenous peoples, mushrooms were looked upon rebirth, regeneration, reclamation, a resurgence of life. So it's interesting that the cultural context steered the science on this subject, because when it came to studying fungi and mushrooms, they were not thought to be important until Alexander Fleming discovered penicillin from the Penicillium chrysogenum, a mold from a cantaloupe that was sourced from a Chicago grocery store that was rotting, of all things. So this mushroom is past its prime. I'm going to go through it. It's decomposing. Spores are germinating. Lots of other things are happening. And then the mushroom goes subterranean. My foot covers approximately 400 miles of mycelium if you stretch those cells end upon end. In a single cubic inch of soil, there can be more than 8 miles. Some people say 1 mile, 1 to 8 miles of these filamentous threads. So every single cubic inch of soil, when you walk upon these landscapes, you're making impressions upon these sentient membranes of mycelium. And they leap up in the aftermath of your footsteps to capture new nutrients that you provided by breaking twigs, by sticks, when you chop wood. It's very interesting that the majority of the psilocybin mushrooms follow the path of our footsteps over the millennia. And I see that as no accident. So the mycelium, I spent many years as a scanning electron microscopist. It's a network-based organism. There's no specific place where you can harm the fungal organism. If you disturb it, it forks. And the mycelium externally digests its nutrients. We internally digest ours. I'll repeat this a few times because these numbers are important. 650 million years ago, we split from fungi. with a new super kingdom, or we like to call it kingdom. Why call it king? Or, you know, kingdom. But 650 million years ago, we split from fungi. We chose the route of encirculating our nutrients into a cellular sac, a stomach. The fungi went the route of externally digesting its nutrients. And these surfaces exude all sorts of enzymes, acids, antibacterial, antiviral compounds. But more importantly, they set up the microbiome. They pre-select the organisms that are necessary to give rise to the plants downstream that create the plants, the canopies that feed the debris fields, that feed the mycelium. These are deterministic organisms. They set the stage for future biological successionism. So as my friend Patrick Hickey produced these fantastic movies over about 6 hours, but these are bundles of nuclei streaming through the mycelial networks. And it's important for you to understand that the mycelium, when it's mature, in many mushroom species, they only have 2 nuclei per cell. But as the mycelium reaches out, at the tips, there's hundreds of nuclei per cell. So think of them as like little scientists. If 2 nuclei come together and they express a new enzyme, a new acid, a new antiviral molecule against a competitor, a new insect, a new toxin, if it is able to regulate and express a new genetic, through epigenesis, able to express a new compound that can release that substance as a food, what happens? The mycelium surges. But more importantly, that information then back channels to the membrane. So as the mycelium grows, the width of my arms here, there can literally be hundreds of millions of end branchings, all of which are very clever in their ability to come up with new strategies to be able to take over a new food source. So I'm going to wax poetic here. I've been talking about this for a long time, but damn it, it's true. So the mycelium shares the archetype of neurons. The mycelium shares the same archetype that which the computer internet is designed. The computer internet, I believe, is an inevitable consequence of a previously proven biologically successful model. Network designs, you know, share nutrients, information, build communities, and are much more resilient to catastrophic events. When you go out and look at the greatest expanse of the universe, this is from a deep field view from the Hubble telescope. These lenses here are galaxies, and this is the cobweb of dark matter. Dark matter also conforms to the same archetype of that of our brain neurons, of the mycelium, of the computer internet. And going even further out now, and this is the widest view of the expanse of the universe, where dark matter and matter forms chains, according to string theory. I believe matter begets life. Life becomes single cells. Single cells become multicellular. They become strings. They fork. Membranes form. Other membranes encounter. They can collaborate or compete. Collaboration leads to greater survival, a lesson for us all. And I think this is the way of life. And I dare say to you today that I propose to you that this may be the construct of universal consciousness. We are all embedded into the archetype of these networks at varying orders of magnitude. So let's go back in time. Now, I might be a left-leaning environmentalist hippie scientist, but I'm well-rooted in science. And so I love to have skeptics, because the skeptics I convert become my best supporters. And I have a lot of supporters now who used to be, you know, rather vocal skeptics. Let's go back in time. About 13.8 billion years ago, boom, the Big Bang. About 4.5 billion years ago, the Earth coalesces. 3.8 billion years ago, the first unicellular organisms have been discovered in the fossil record. That's the origin of life. Did life come from outer space? Maybe through viruses. That's very, very possible. So here's what's been published in the past 2 months. Fossilized mycelium, 2.4 billion years old, has been found on lava beds in Australia. Now, animals split from fungi 650 million years ago, about 1.7 billion years later, then the mycelium that you see in this fossil, this is published in Nature Ecology, a very, very reputable journal. So this means that we are descended from mycelium. Filamentous we are descended from our filamentous ancestors. The mycelium is the mother of all animals. We are the consequence over more than a billion years, 1.7 billion years it took fungi testing to create animals. So when you understand that the mycelium is the mother of animals and that we are descended from these filamentous networks, I think it suggests very strongly that there's a deep heritage of knowledge that we can tap into. So this article just came out in the past 2 months. 1.2 billion years old. And animals split from fungi 550 million years later. This is amazing. Mushrooms are soft, but it was in a sediment that just happened to have enough minerals to be able to fossilize the form of a mushroom. Think of this. Mushrooms had their form before we did, hundreds of millions of years earlier. Now, I think this is profound and strikes to the very core of our being. 250 million years ago at the PT boundary, the Permian-Triassic boundary, we had a great catastrophic event. Some people think it was from an asteroid impact possible, methane hydrate burst from the ocean, caused this massive extinction, that's possible. Volcanoes in Siberia, that's possible. They aren't mutually exclusive. An asteroid impact could have created the earthquakes that liberated the methane hydrate burst from the ocean and also caused the volcanoes to explode, to jettison. But the earth became shrouded in dust. Sunlight was cut off. Massive extinction, according to the fossil record. Animals died, and fungi inherited the earth because they did not require light. We advanced forward to this asteroid impact, and then at that time at the PT boundary, 250 million years ago in the fossil record, we find all this mycelium that gobbled up the forest. It was given actually a name, Reduviosporinides. And so this is the predominant, in the fossil record, the predominant fungus that occurred at that time. So we advance forward to 140 million years ago, and we're in the time of Gondwana land, where we have separation and drifting of the continents. And then we come to 65 million years ago, we have another extinction event. The dinosaurs became extinct. We all know this. 65 million years ago, that asteroid impact occurred just north of the Yucatan Peninsula. Also, the Earth became shrouded in dust. Massive die-off of animals and plants, and fungi re-inherited the Earth. There's a recurring theme here, folks. When we're involved in extinction events, by pairing in with fungi, you have a better chance of survival. We have now entered into 6X, the sixth largest extinction event known in the history of this world. We have an estimated 8.3 million species on this planet. But the conservative estimates by evolutionary biologists now, and by biologists generally, is we're losing about 30,000 species per year. Do the math. And 30,000 species per year in 100 years, that means we're losing more than 3 million species, more than a third of the biodiversity of our planet, is going to be lost here in the next 100 years. That dismantling and unraveling of the ecosystem is eroding the food support system that has gotten us here to where we are today. The largest organism on this planet thus far discovered is a mycelial mat in eastern Oregon, 2,200 acres in size, 1,665 football fields, and it's one cell wall thick. We have four or five skin layers that protect us from an infection. The mycelium has one. And on the other side of that is hundreds of millions of microbes trying to consume it. How is it possible that it achieves the largest size and mass of any organism on the planet? Because of the constant, intelligent, biomedical communication with its ecosystem. And through epigenesis and responding to a variety of stimuli, is able to build up the intelligence skill sets that are needed to be able to grow to these massive sizes. Now, so I like telling stories. So anyhow, this photograph was really hard for me to get. I rented an airplane at a Boeing field. It was a canvas-covered airplane with a bush pilot from Alaska. We flew down there because it was published in scientific literature where the lat-long was coordinates. We couldn't find it. You know, we found all these dead trees. We went back. We checked the literature. We were right there, but we were too low in elevation. So we spiraled up to about 14,500 feet from sea level. And I'm in the back of this little airplane, And I said, we have to go higher, higher, because I could see it sort of emerging, but I want to be able to get the whole thing in one in my Nikon camera. And just before I took this photograph, I told the pilot, I think I'm going to faint. And the pilot goes, me too. So okay, I said, let me get the photograph. Let's get down. Anyhow, so it's the best photograph, I think, of the largest organism in the world ever taken. Anyhow. So, anybody in the back there, if you can resize a little bit by shrinking the image, that'd be great. So soil networks become more connected and take up more carbon as nature restoration progresses. So when you destroy an ecosystem, farming, you cut down the trees, it becomes bacterially dominant for the first several years. But after 70 years, could you just shrink it a little bit? Yeah. After 70 years, 75% of the carbon is fungal. So after ecosystems recover and build sustainable networks, it's through the mycelial networks, and the majority of the carbon biologically in the soil is from fungi. My manly man picture. So we only have 10 to 15% of the wood debris that's naturally occurs in the soil. Whoa, wrong direction. I like the emphasis. So 70% of soils are microbial. 30% of those soils are fungal. That means about 20% of the mass of soil are fungal. Think of that. You grab a hunk of soil, 20% of that is pure fungal tissue, living and dead. So my partner Dusty here, we go to the old growth forest a lot, and she's been instrumental in a lot of this research, and she's picking a nice polypore mushroom out of the old growth forest. And this is an amazing rock painting from northern Algeria. It's from the Tisilian Anjar Plateau. Now, the first image, this is the actual rock pictograph, and then it's been redrawn by a friend of mine, Jonathan Meter, so you can see it. And this is very clear what the artist intended to communicate. But scientists and researchers publishing these articles with this image would not dare to say what's obvious. Is that the artist was very, very, getting better. You got it. Good. The artist was very excited about mushrooms, don't you think? And by putting the mushrooms in the honey, it was a way of preserving them. So psychoactive honey from mushrooms was a long, long-held tradition. And then the Bavarian Beer Act of 1516 banned mushrooms specifically. The Catholic Church banned mushrooms specifically to be involved in making beer or meads, because that was a struggle between polytheism and monotheism. You had European pagan cultures going out in the forest to celebrate nature, and Christianity comes and said, no, you have to go into a church and pay our priests in order to have a gateway to God. And so there was a clash between paganism and first peoples and animism and looking at nature as all citizens, equal citizens in the ecosphere, versus this domination of a hierarchical, patriarchal monotheistic religion. So I'm going to come back to this because this is, to me, more profound than it is first evident. So I'm going to talk a little bit about psilocybin mushrooms, something that I have a specialty in. Now, Demeter gave Persephone a mushroom, and upon ingest, this is from 450 BCE, and the Persephone, upon ingesting the mushroom, went into sleep, slumber, went into the underworld. That was the onset of winter in Greek mythology. In the spring, she came back up, the rebirth of the springs. And Maria Sabina is giving R. Gordon Wasson psilocybe cerulescens, one of the greatest women shamans of our time. And my brother John here is presenting psilocybe semilantiata. I show these to you because many of you know this. When you give a sacrament of a mushroom to somebody else who is receiving it, it's presente. You're giving something that's very important. Pay attention. I'm giving you something that's sacred. And so I find that very interesting that the hand delivery is very, very similar. So Dustin and I are the temporary keepers of 18 Mesoamerican mushroom stones. We plan to repatriate them back to Guatemala. The oldest mushroom stones we have are 2,500 years old. These mushroom stones were made between 3,000 years, who knows, but the oldest one we have is 2,500, to about 500 years A.D. There are square ones, there are tripod ones, there are round ones, but these, we think, were like the coat of arms of a family, but the conquistadors, by edict of the Pope, they were told to destroy all idolatry, all idols that would challenge Christianity. And so these were destroyed by the tens of thousands. There's only about 200 of them known in the world today. And these mushroom stones may have marked property boundaries to invoke rain, because there were major droughts in Mesoamerica that stressed that population. So it's very interesting to me that these mushroom stones survived today. They were buried and hidden, because when the conquistadors came over, they brought over syphilis, debatedly tuberculosis, but they brought over all sorts of, they brought over smallpox, and there was no immunological history with the native peoples, so they were wiped out. And so when their shamans could not protect the indigenous people, many of the indigenous people converted to Christianity because they were promised eternal life. And then they were basically incentivized to become snitches, to snitch on their neighbors who had these mushroom stones, so that then they could be killed or thrown into jail if they didn't renounce their pagan religion. So these mushroom stones are just yet another artifact that we can see back in time that you know, strengthens the historical importance of the use of these mushrooms. So my professors, Dr. Michael Bew is in the upper left. He's still alive. Alexander Smith was one of my mentors, University of Michigan. And Dr. Daniel Stuntz in the lower left from the University of Washington, and Catherine Skates from Post Falls, Idaho. These are giants in the field of mycology. I got into mycology when I was really about 5 years old, but I really got into it when I was 14 or 15. So when I met Dr. Michael Bugh at the Evergreen State College, I was self-taught. I was going to the University of Washington. At the time, some of you may know this, you try to find any literature on psychoactive drugs or plants or mushrooms, you go in the libraries and people had razored out the pages. They were so desperate to get information. So the books were pilfered all the time of the knowledge of psychoactive substances. So, but Alexander Smith and Daniel Stuntz had really big libraries. So they knew my interests were legitimate, and they invited me into the libraries so I could study. It was all the more remarkable they invited me in, because this is what I look like. This is me when I'm 21. So even though I am balding, my brothers out there, you know, we share a common semblance to a great degree. So that's my first cook of Psilocybe cubensis, by the way. So my brother John first got me involved in mushrooms. He died, unfortunately, on June 9th, 2014. He's a renowned photographer in Seattle. And my brother John, I grew up in a large house in Ohio, and in the basement we had a fully equipped laboratory. I'm talking three rows of chemical shelves. My father served on the USS Intrepid, the aircraft carrier, and then after World War II, he got the Intrepid aircraft carrier radio. So it was in my basement. Now, my alpha brother John, I'm the youngest one in the family, he wouldn't let me play in the laboratory. He was doing serious chemistry. And so I could play on the radio, listen behind the Iron Curtain, all sorts of coded messages and whatnot. But John went on to go to Yale. My brother Bill went on to go to Cornell. My twin brother went on to Reed, and my sister went on to Ohio State. But when my three older siblings went on, they left my twin brother and I alone with a fully equipped laboratory. And that just really inspired me. I mean, every experiment that said danger, do not bring near flame. Woo, okay, let's try that one. So, but I always, that imprinted me, because I thought, when I grow up, I want to be a scientist, you know, doing research in my own laboratory. Now, I'm very happy to say that my partner Dusty and I, we have 78 employees now. I packed 30,000 boxes before I had a single employee. I paid bills on the date of disconnection with the electrical company and the phone company for over 15 years. You can look this up, 360-426-8255. That is the phone number for PUD, the electrical company. My lawyer said you didn't have to pay the bill until the date of disconnection. If you make a phone call, they can't disconnect you. So I did this as a Zen-like practice for over 10 years, to the point that I later on met some of these people at the Public Utility District, and they said they would sit around at 8:01 in the morning with their coffee cups. They're saying, Paul Stamets is going to call. And Paul Stamets would call, they'd all cheer. It was kind of their, they always shut the phone, the power off on a Monday. So they come up on Monday morning, we have our coffee, Paul's going to call. So I did that. I laid in bed. I spent many nights, I'm not ashamed to admit it, crying. I bounced hundreds of checks. The bank, my lawyer went to the bank and said, he's bouncing checks, but he's one of your best customers. Look at all of my overdraft fees he's paid, you know? So I'm really happy to say now I own 100% of my company. I have no debt. And through just sheer stamina, now we can use the funds to do some of the research you're about to see. And I think this research effort is one of the culminations of my life. So, so growing up in Ohio, my brother John comes back from Yale, and he brings back this book, Altered States of Consciousness. You know, he's five years older than me, and so he was 18, 19, I was 14. So I was really excited. My older brother, I loved him, you know, and he was, you know, really exciting. He went down to Mexico, Colombia, came back with amazing stories of tripping on magic mushrooms of South America and Mesoamerica. So John lent me this book, and I go, John, and he goes, well, I need it back, you know, after the semester, after vacation. I needed to go back to Yale. It's part of my course. So I got the book, you know, I had it for 2 weeks. And then my best friend, Ryan, he wanted to borrow the book. And I go, listen, this is my brother John's book. I'll let you have it for like 2 or 3 days, but you got to give it back to me. So Ryan said, I promise. So he takes the book, and Ryan goes away. And then a few days later, I said, Ryan, I need the book back. And he delayed, stalled. A few more days, Ryan, I need the book back. Yeah, more delays, excuses. And then finally, my brother's coming back. He needs this book for his course. Ryan, I need my book. Ryan goes, I can't give you your book, Paul. I said, why? He says, my father burned it. And I went, whoa. If this book had knowledge in it that was so potent that it inspired his father to burn it, I know what I'm going to focus on. So this led to many years of research. I've published now 4-5 new psilocybin active species. Here they are. The most potent psilocybe in the world is called psilocybe agirescens on the left. Psilocybe liniformans variety Americana, Psilocybe cynofibulosa, Psilocybe wilii, after my dear friend Dr. Andrew Weil, who also had a chapter, by the way, in Altered States of Consciousness, and then later on we've become best friends. In fact, Andy's not far from here right now. So right after this lecture, a few hours later, Andy and I hook up and we go on our vision quest to see the eclipse. So there, full circle, I'm a 14-year-old boy reading this book, this chapter by Andy Weil, and become best friends later in life. That's kind of cool. So we were covered by a Drug Enforcement Administration license, which we had for over 10 years. So all of our research was legit. I could grow lots of cubensis legally. I thought everybody was a narc. So I was super paranoid. I'm paranoid anyhow. But I have this motto, nature provides, I don't. Okay? So, you know, people ask me if psilocybin mushrooms. I say, well, get a book. Go out and find them yourself, you know. So I've never been involved in the trafficking of psilocybin mushrooms. But that's what's kept me safe. I draw the line very, very carefully. So, now, interestingly, psilocybe cubensis grows on a wide variety of dung in the tropics. Elephant, hippopotamus, antelope, horse, zebras. And it is the most bodaciously obvious mushroom growing in dung. So let's set the stage here for what is probable, not possible, what's probable. It turns out that there are 23
primates that consume mushrooms. Well, we're a primate. There's 22 other primates that consume mushrooms. And they know how to identify them, which ones are good and which ones are not. The Golgi monkey from the Bolivia and the Amazon consumes 12 times its body weight in a mushroom called Ascopolyprus. Americans consume about 1.9 kilograms per year, less than 3% of our body weight. So for 23 primates to have a long history of identifying and consuming mushrooms suggests some really ancestral knowledge that goes way back in time. So I want to revisit something here called the stoned ape hypothesis. Now, Terence McKenna, Brother Terence, is a great psychonaut, you know, friend of many of us, and I want to give tribute to him. Terence and I were good friends, but I could argue with Terence. And I'll say this, and I said this to Terence to his face. Other people have said the same thing. 90% of what you say, Terence McKenna, is total bullshit. But that 10%, you know, that 10%, that's pure gold, right? That's, you're into something. So he called it a stoned ape theory. I want to make it very clear here. This is a hypothesis because we can't prove it. So 200,000 years ago, our ancestors' brain suddenly doubled from about 1.5 pounds to 3 pounds. In evolutionary terms, that's huge. Now, it goes back and forth another 100,000, further back by some estimates. 140,000 years ago, Homo erectus became extinct. 40,000 years ago, and Neanderthals became extinct within 4,000 years of contact. We are a brutal species. You know, we killed other competing primates off very quickly. My 23andMe report, I'm a 2.9% Neanderthal. Woohoo! Some of you are more, some of you are less, but we intermingled with Neanderthals. So Terence made a mistake. He gave Roland Fisher, that published an article in around 1970 on psilocybin-induced constriction of near space. And basically, it was a scientist doing work on schizophrenia, and he thought that psilocybin mushrooms, because people could narrowly focus, was similar to a schizophrenic's preoccupation with looking at things very small. Terence... He actually tried to give credit to this guy. I've read this article 3 or 4 times now. It really has nothing to do with the stone ape hypothesis. Terence was being overly generous in giving attribution to a scientist that really Terence gets credit for this. No one else but Terence. So now, what does it mean to be human? And these are great painting by Alex Gray and Alex and Allison. I want to here officially dedicate my talk to you today. You know, they are... They can bring so many of these concepts into the visual expression of art. And art and science, I think, are weaving together as we go into the future. So this just talks about this sudden increase in brain size as it relates to climate change. But it led to glossolalia, the ability to speak, to creativity. And so if your ancestors coming out of the trees of the tropics and through climate change, the savannas increased, you would hunt animals. Now, those of you who've tracked animals, I mean, what do you look for? Well, you look for tracks on the prairie. But the majority of primates are grub eaters. They eat larvae. And larvae lay eggs in the scat, in the dung. And so you look for footprints, you look for scat, you look for larvae to eat, and you run into these giant mushrooms. You're hungry. Your clan is going across the prairie. You find these mushrooms. I'm hungry. Let's eat them. Okay, I'll share. You share it with your family. You're catapulted into this incredible experience. The stars become fractals. You have depth perception like never before. You're laughing, you're hugging each other, you're sharing an altered state of consciousness, like something that you've never experienced before. It opens up your heart, your chakra, you engage in community, you understand that life is all interconnected. Rocks have a life form, a life energy about them. Okay, so that happens once. No. It happens twice. No. It happens thousands, millions, and millions, and millions, and millions of times over millions of years. Epigenesis is the expression of from the genome, a genetic expression in response to our environmental stimulus. This is not one stimulus. This is a cascade of stimuli hitting the human genome over millions of years. I believe that the stoned ape hypothesis that Terence espoused makes a lot of sense for the sudden doubling of the brain of Homo sapiens. So a hypothesis is an educated guess to explain an observable phenomenon. A theory is a hypothesis that has been tested by science and factually supported. So that's the difference between a hypothesis and a theory. This is why I call it the stoned ape hypothesis, because we might be able to prove this. Maybe, maybe not. Now there is a surge in microdosing throughout Silicon Valley. Many, many people here are involved in microdosing. There's many experts on microdosing in this audience. It has been written up in the Wall Street Journal, Forbes magazine, Inc. magazine. It's the rave right now with coders in Silicon Valley to give them a competitive edge in creativity and coming up with end runs around problems that they face in the computer sciences. So now microdosing is taking a below threshold dose of psilocybin, below that you can feel. Well, maybe 1 gram, you feel cubensis, you know. The next day you have 1 gram, little bit of feeling. Next day you don't feel anything. So you normalize to it very quickly. Microdosing on the psilocybin cubensis scale of 5 grams is a hero's journey. That's like going to the 10th floor. 1 gram is like going to the first floor. You can start to feel it. So the microdosing is anywhere between a tenth of a gram to a gram of psilocybin cubensis, using that one. That's the most common one that people consume that has been grown. So it turns out that it was discovered that psilocybin recently causes neurogenesis, and it helps to extinguish the conditioned fear response. And they did this first with rats in order to condition them to be fearful. They'd have a stimulus and a pain, and they were traumatized, form of PTSD. And then giving them the psilocybin, they were able to renormalize and extinguish the fear response. So they were able to overcome their trepidation that they're going to be harmed or feel badly. Well, this is the same with humans as well. There's several clinical studies. Roland Griffiths, many of you know, Johns Hopkins University, UCLA, New York University, all now are very much actively involved in treating PTSD using psilocybin in therapeutic settings. So psilocybin, because it eliminates the fear conditioning response, induces courage, because you're not longer fearful, and kindness. You want to hug your brother and sister. You want to forgive them. You say life is more important than these small little hiccups that we get involved in these arguments. So, well, if psilocybin induces courage and kindness, these are leadership skills. And I think our society would be a lot better if our leaders would be dosing themselves regularly with psilocybin. Donald and Ivanka Trump, Jeff Sessions, are you listening? Okay, across the United States, in the middle of the Cold War, 1957, Life magazine was delivered that was a field guide to psilocybin mushrooms that described R. Gordon Wasson's adventures into Mexico and meeting Maria Sabina. So here's a complete field guide to how to identify psilocybin mushrooms delivered to millions of Americans. So R. Gordon Wasson, Dr. Daniel Stuntz, and Dr. Gaston Guzman are three of the big people in the field of mycology who published a lot of new species and with whom I worked. Psilocybe stuntzii was named after Dr. Daniel Stuntz in the center there holding a new species that found at the University of Washington campus called Psilocybe stuntzii. Now, my brother John, just before the species was published, you know, he was living in Seattle, and I'm living in Olympia. He says, "Paul, I think I found some." I go, "Found what, John?" He goes, "I think I found some psilocybes."
I said, John, I don't identify mushrooms over the phone, but you're a smart guy. Let me ask you a few questions. And I said, okay, John, did it have a purple-brown spore print? He goes, yes, it does. I did that. Okay, do you have the mushrooms there? He goes, yes. Does it have a separable gelatinous pellicle? It's a skin that many of the temperate wood chip psilocybes have, this little translucent membrane. Break the cap and peel it very slowly. He goes, yes, it's got a separable gelatinous pellicle. I go, okay, Is it brewing bluish at the base of the stem? He goes, yeah, they're bruising bluish everywhere. I go, whoa. Well, John, you may have found some. How many did you find? He said, you will not believe it. I said, come up here right away. So I drove to Seattle. The next morning, John goes, well, we got to be fast. We'll need a lot of grocery bags. Okay, I said, all right, why do we have to be fast? He goes, well, you'll see. And so we went down the University of Washington, those of you from Seattle, you know where Boat Street is. At the end of Boat Street, there is a police substation. So John and I show up with two of our other friends, and the cop cars are going in, the cop cars are going out, the cop cars are going in, they're going out, let's go, you know. And so we started picking crazily, and there's such an eruption of psilocybes, it lifted up trash, debris, everything, right off the ground, 4 inches. So we're picking, we got about 10 grocery bags full, and then other University of Washington students are walking by and says, what are you doing? And I go, oh, nothing. Pretty soon they got involved. I mean, it was just amazing. I mean, we collected so many psilocybin, so many of these psilocybin stuntii. That became part of the holotype defining the new species that was named after Daniel Stuntz, psilocybin stuntii. So anyhow, so that was a time in the 70s, the huge surge of interest in psilocybin mushrooms, particularly on the west coast of North America. So psilocybin stuntii, and it's all of its splendor, it's got a ring on the stem. And then at the first psychoactive mushroom conference in 1976, I'm 21 years of age. I matured. I went through puberty early. And we went with Dr. Gaston Guzman, a wildcat mushroom adventure collecting trip from Southern Oregon. I'm good friends with Ken Kesey before he died, the Merry Pranksters. And actually, Dusty and I are officially Merry Pranksters. So we have the plaque signed down by Mountain Girl and Ken Kesey and Ken Babbs and George Walker and Mystery. So we stopped. We saw the Kesey family because they were into psilocybes as well. And we went and collected mushrooms, all of them down up into Vancouver, British Columbia. So the Terrence McKenna, Gary Menser, Stephen Pollock, and Andrew Weil were some of the larger personalities that are very focused in on this movement. So Dr. Michael Bug got the Drug Enforcement Administration license, and the three of us, Jonathan Ott, Jeremy Bigwood, and myself, were protected under the DEA license. That was amazing because the three of us went on to publish about 14 books. And this is a really nerdy professor. And I love him dearly, but this guy's a total nerd. It's so great. It was great for him to interface with the DEA because, of course, you know, we don't look like that. So my big thanks to my professor, Michael Bug. And went on, many books got published. And the story I was told that the inheritor of a Golden Guide publishing company was a hippie, a psychonaut, and when he inherited the Golden Guide, you know, they put out minerals and how to identify birds, things like that. So he thought, what a great idea for kids. Let's put out the Golden Guide to Hallucinogenic Plants. This was very short-lived. The PTA, the school organizations had an uprising. So this now sells for about $500 a piece, and it was selling for $2 a piece at the time. So this is our friend Ken Kesey. So Ken and I have love of chainsaws. You know, I used to be a logger, so was he. And so I created Sporus de Illuminatus, Omni Psilocybe Munda. 200 million spores of psilocybe per milliliter of oil. So as you're chainsawing your trees, you're inoculating the trees with psilocybin mushrooms. And I thought that was kind of fun. This went on to, we sponsored a number of conferences from 1976 to 2017, the Millennium Mushroom Conference, psychoactivity conferences in Europe. Psilocybe semilanciata and Psilocybe pelliculosa were two of the really common ones, one in the field, one in the forest. And then psilocybe, cynophibulosa, baeocystis, alenii, and liniformans. Just common psilocybe mushrooms. And then the psilocybe cynescens on the left, psilocybe azurescens on the right. Azurescens is a huge mushroom. It's the most potent psilocybin mushroom in the world. Up to 2% of its mass is psilocybin and psilocin. Psilocybin dephosphorylates into psilocin. You eat psilocybin. Psilocin gets through the blood-brain barrier. So I'm going to show you something that I discovered. And I show this for the research scientists who have DEA licenses. But here's psilocybe azurescens on the left. And it took me 30 years to figure this out. You take ice cubes, you chop up the mushroom, and you let ice cubes melt at 1 degree over freezing, 33 degrees, over 5 to 6 days, and you can pull out blue juice. And the blue juice then can be frozen as ice cubes. Wouldn't it be a great thing to have today, right? Psilocybin mushrooms may be the first smart mushroom, but there's another mushroom I want you to see, and it causes neurogenesis. And another mushroom is called lion's mane, Herbaceum arenaceus. And lion's mane causes neurogenesis and rebuilding myelin on the axons of nerves. And there's some very interesting, there have been two clinical studies showing that lion's mane consumption increases cognitive function in humans who are going through dementia. Modest, you know, gains. But there's two mouse experiments that I think is fascinating. And one is, you know, they put 100 mice into an arena, and the mice are running around. They put it in, and they have an exit, a corridor. It's called a Y test. The left corridor at the Y goes to food. The right one does not. Well, the mice very quickly, 100 mice figure out, go left, go get food. So they're there. They get very good data. They all go to food. Very quickly learn which way to go. So then they gave a polypeptide that induces amyloid plaque that causes demyelination. And they started dosing the mice with this, and after a few weeks, the mice could begin to get full-blown dementia. Demyelination occurs. Without myelin, you don't have good neurotransmission. So it's what happens also in Alzheimer's patients. When they dissect the brain, they see amyloid plaque formation and demyelination. So then the mice then randomized. They went left and right equally because they were confused. They had no short-term memory. So they gave those mice then the same mice, and they gave them lion's mane mushrooms. And after about 2 to 3 weeks, about 75 to 80% of them regained the ability to memorize which way to go. Sacrificing the mice, they found that they regenerated myelin. The amyloid plaques largely dissolved, and regeneration neurogenesis occurred. Now, the other experiment I find far more fascinating. 100 mice in an arena, and they put in a new toy. And they're there with stopwatches or, you know, counters to find out how many points of contact. The mice, new toy, oh, excited. They go up and they sniff it, click. They did that, they got hundreds and hundreds of data points. They got the normalized data field. They also then injected the amyloid plaque polypeptide-inducing compound. And then after 2 weeks, when they put a new toy in, they were not interested. Lack of inquisitiveness, lack of curiosity. And then with those mice, they did the same thing. They fed them lion's mane mushrooms. Several weeks later, they then began to renormalize, regain their creativity. Upon sacrificing the mice, the same thing. They saw remyelination. So I think there's a good way of stacking psilocybin mushrooms with lion's mane mushrooms. So this is just the neurogenesis. So I propose to you a formula. Psilocybin and psilocin. I'll leave it up on the screen here for a minute or two if people want to take a photograph or write it down. It's a new nootropic vitamin complex. Now, I'm going to date myself here a little bit. But in the 1970s, it was widely known throughout the tribe that if you took niacin, vitamin B, nicotinic acid, you could come down from LSD or mushrooms. A show of hands here, how many people remember that? So quite a few of us knew that, the counter the effects. Well, that's actually very interesting because I was thinking about this, and it's contrary to conventional wisdom,
But when you take niacin, you get a heat flush. You get redness. You get excitation of your nerve endings. Well, I thought niacin then could be a great chemical vehicle for driving neurogenic compounds to the end branchings of the nerves, thus making sure the psilocybin and the lion's mane compounds called aranacines make it all the way through, because neuropathy often occurs at the fingertips, at the toes, at the extremities. So this is something that we hope to have involved in a clinical study in the next 2 or 3 years. It looks very likely that psilocybin will go to a Schedule II drug, which means that it has therapeutic use. And so I'm hoping that this could be tested. Now, I want to tell you a short story by a friend of mine, Bill Webb, who's since deceased. Bill Webb was a friend of Henry Miller, who wrote a whole bunch of books in the 60s, as well as Ansel Adams, the great photographer. Bill and I tripped together the first time when I was 18. He was much older than me. He was a father figure to me. He was a very important person in my life. Bill, about 6 months before he died, he calls me up and says, "Paul, I'm going to tell you something, and I want to make sure you tell other people." I said, "Okay, Bill." He goes, "Paul, what I'm going to tell you is very important." I go, "Okay, Bill." I said, "Paul, I want you to promise me." I go, "Okay, Bill, I got it. What is it?" And he goes, "I have to tell you a story." He said, the worst thing about getting old is losing your senses, your hearing, your sight. He has a hearing aid, which he hated. He lived on the cliffs of Big Sur. He could not hear the waves or the seagulls. And he said, "But I was tripping on 5 grams of Psilocybe cubensis. And I noticed, I didn't need my hearing aid. I could hear the waves. I could hear the seagulls." He was totally blissed out, laying on his wooden deck, above the cliffs of Big Sur. And then he was just, everything was fine. Then he hears this click, 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 click. And he goes, "What's that?" And he hears click, 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 click. And he goes, "What's that?" And he said it bothered him. It's like, "What the heck is making this clicking sound?" He'd rub his ears and he couldn't figure it out. And he looked over and there are ants walking past him, as the footsteps of the ants walking past him. This is a metric that can be measured. So I told this to Roland Griffiths and other researchers, here is something that you can measure. That the psilocybin mushrooms increase visual acuity, we all know that, but also increases your hearing, your ability to hear. Those are evolutionary advantageous tools that we can put to use. So those who are out there are involved in research on this, I would love this to be studied, very, very carefully in a clinical setting. So I'm going to go back to the bee shaman. So I promised you actionable, ecologically rational, economically sustainable, paradigm-shifting solutions that are born out of the psychedelic experience that I have had with psilocybin mushrooms. This is a continuity of knowledge over the millennia. And First Peoples and Native Americans have exactly right, the concept of 7 generations. We should get away from short trading and the stock market. We should think about sustainable, and the profits for the long term for the benefit of the commons. So here's the bee shaman. Well, we know that mushrooms and honey is one way to preserve them. We are now, bees are undergoing a rapid extinction. It's called a colony collapse disorder. It's an umbrella term, but the bees are under many stressors, and the bees are becoming extinct, are declining in vast numbers all over the world. So here's a short little clip my friend Louis Schwartzberg made of bees going to pollination of tomatoes. The bees come in. Now, the normal foraging time of bees is 9 days. When you see bees on a flower, that's the last 9 days of their life. Well, that was a normal foraging time. Now the average is 4 to 5 days. So the bee foraging ability has been reduced. They can't pollinate as much as they did before because their lifespans have been cut in half. 36% of the colonies were lost in the United States in 2014 and 15, 44% in 2015-16, more than 45% is in 2017. The presidential memorandum identifies these stressors: bee nutrition, forage lands, parasites, especially mites, and viruses, lack of genetic diversity, exposure to pesticides, neonicotinoids. This chart was just published by Bee Informed, dot org. Oklahoma lost 84% of the beehives in Oklahoma died this year. 75% died in Delaware. If you know anything about pandemics, when you have hot spots, they emanate outwards. 1984, I think it was, the varroa mite was introduced from Asia. The varroa mite bites the bees. It's like a dirty syringe, and they inject viruses, especially a virus known as a deformed wing virus. So neonicotinoid insecticides are causing the male bees to become sterile. Baron Syngenta, many of you saw this on my Facebook page, I think, and saw it in the news. They sponsored a study on neonicotinoids in Europe, fully thinking that neonicotinoids would not harm bees. About 10 scientists were involved in this. The information, the research results were concluded, and Baron Syngenta did everything they could to suppress publication of this article that showed a dramatic effect on second-generation bees, that neonicotinoids unequivocally decimate bee health in multiple generations subsequent to exposure. So this article has now been published in a renowned peer-reviewed journal. Neonicotinoids should and will be banned in Europe very, very shortly. Glyphosates in Roundup Ready corn and other, you know, soybeans, etc. These interfere with your mineral absorption. Glyphosates were approved by the EPA for a very short study on bees, just for a few weeks. It interferes with the microbiome. It disrupts the microbiome, which then interferes with the nutrition absorptions of bees, and the bees undergo malaise. So another stressor on the bees. Here is your food at a grocery store with the benefit of bees. This is what the store selection will look in the dairy section without bee pollination. The entomologists that I've spoken to are fearful that in 10 years, commercial bee pollination services will no longer be available worldwide. This is a direct threat to worldwide food biosecurity. Now, interestingly, in a survey, saving the bees was the number one bridge issue between Republicans and Democrats. So when you're at Thanksgiving dinner or Christmas or Hanukkah, and you're back at home, and you know your family are polar opposites politically, talk about bees. You know, everyone wants to save the bees, right? A series of weird events occurred in my life. It's an epiphany that took 30 years for my dull brain to figure this out. So here's a 30-year epiphany with a series of events that seemingly are not congruous, but build to something that I think is quite remarkable. This is the garden giant mushroom. It's friendly in the garden. It eats nematodes in the garden. It's great to have as a companion. It's a big mushroom. And I planted some in my garden in 1984. And I planted them, and the mushrooms started coming up. I went out there to water them, and I couldn't believe what I saw. I looked very closely, and bees had come to my mushroom patch, and they moved the wood chips away. And I could see them sucking on the mycelium of this garden giant mushroom. I went, that's interesting. The next day, same thing. The next day, continuous convoys of bees from my beehives to my garden giant bed, even though there's flowers all around, for 44 days, there's a continuous convoy of bees, from my beehives to my mycelial bed, and it shrunk the bed. It sucked it down. Wow. Now, this was published in Harrowsmith Magazine in 1988. I put it in one of my books, Growing Gourmet Medicinal Mushrooms, in 1994. And I thought, well, you know, the mycelium is breaking down the wood and it's making fungal sugars, polysaccharides. The bees probably like the sugars. So I published this. Everybody ignored me except for a beekeeper in Ontario who wrote me saying, maybe that's why bees go to sawdust piles in the summertime. Thereupon, I forgot about this. I spent a lot of time in the old growth forest. Bear scratch trees. And Dusty, when she moved to Washington State, you know, we live right near a beautiful salmon stream, a wild salmon, Kennedy Creek, Washington. And my neighbor had killed over 400 bears under contract from the Forest Service, because in the state of Washington, the timber harvest funded the schools. And so the Forest Service and the state forest officials put a bounty on bears, because the bears scratch the trees, a polypore mushroom would grow, kill the trees, so the bears were hurting the budgets of the schools. So hundreds of bears were killed in order to protect the timber harvest in Washington State. So bears scratch trees, bear scratch, and resin comes out of the trees, and the bees collect this for propolis. And so these are lots of bees surrounding the scratches where the resin's coming out, and the bees use this to patch their hive for entries with the wasps and other predators can't get in. It also has antimicrobial properties. So we're hiking in the old-growth forest of the Olympic National Park down the trail that time forgot, and truly did, and we're bushwhacking it, and we go around the corner, and Dusty, I think, sees this first. We see this bear scratch. Now, this is the best bear scratch I've ever seen. The bear goes up, you know, and so I went, wow. And so, well, you know, this is why they killed the bears, is because if it's true what they thought, then we should come back here in 2 years and see what happened to this tree. Now, we orienteered us off the trail. And so 2 years later, it took us hours, about 5 hours, we found the original tree. This is 4 or 5 inches of rain in that day, and there's the bear scratch. And sure enough, this red-belted polypore mushroom called Fomitopsis panicula, you've all seen it. It's the most common polypore mushroom in the world in temperate regions. It grows on deciduous and conifer trees. It's got a kind of orangish-red band on it. Sure enough, that mushroom came out of the bear scratch. Okay? So that's like the first experience in my garden. That's like mycofactor number one. This is mycofactor number two. So I'm slowly putting these things together. And so here's a short movie that played on PBS. I'll give my voice a break here for a second. So we'll watch this, then I'll come back. Good. Turn it up.
Wow. Very nice. These girls are fantastic. I lift that lid up and those girls are solid across there, and they're making honey and they're making babies.
Eric Olson owns more colonies than any beekeeper in Washington State.
Hot dog! There's nothing greater than to open a beehive and see them doing well.
They're doing well today.
Look at that! I'm really tickled with this.
But just months ago, he opened his hives and discovered nearly half his bees were dead.
I spent 20 years as a pilot in the Air Force in my share of combat situations, and I never was as low as I was when all those bees were dead. That's the lowest time of my life.
It turns out this may be the new normal. The U.S. Department of Agriculture says that nearly half of colonies across the country died in the 2014 season. Big losses have been happening for years, and scientists haven't pinpointed what's causing them. They say more than 60 factors may play a role in collapsing colonies. Factors like pesticides, malnutrition, and loss of habitat.
If we don't find some answer, I am really concerned about whether these little girls will survive.
But one unlikely solution may be growing close by, in the forests of western Washington.
Oh, there's another one.
Enter Paul Stamets. He's a pioneer in the study of mushrooms.
This is a beautiful specimen. The white margin here means it's growing really well. It's what I call happy mushrooms. Makes me a happy person too.
I'm involved in the study of fungi ever since a very young age. My initial interest was magic mushrooms, and then I got into edible mushrooms and medicinal mushrooms, and my mother was much happier.
Stamets scours the forest for rare types of fungi.
I use mycology and the use of fungi to help clean up the environment. and prove the immune system of animals. And I began to think, we've gone to the moon, we've gone to Mars, and we don't know the way of the bee.
All right.
You know, I bet you I could do something to help the bees.
Stamets recently discovered a mushroom that might be able to take on one of the honeybee's worst enemies.
And that's called the varroa mite, with the name Varroa destructor.
Varroa mites began wreaking havoc on U.S. beehives in 1996.
We lost about half the colonies east of the Mississippi over that winter.
Steve Shepard is an entomologist at Washington State University. He's spent decades trying to understand how varroa mites cripple honeybees. He says they invade hives and attach themselves to infant bees.
I always think of it as having something about the size of a pancake feeding on you.
They live off bee blood and transmit a slew of viruses to their hosts. Some sickly bees lose the ability to fly and gather food for the hive. Many end up dying prematurely.
They'll kill the colony within a couple of years unless beekeepers intervene.
That's why Shepard decided to try a new approach.
Something doesn't look quite right with it.
Yeah, it'll never fly.
He teamed up with Paul Stamets. Stamets told him about a type of fungus that's highly attractive and highly lethal to termites. Shepard wondered what this termite-killing mushroom extract would do to the varroa mite.
So we should do something with this hive, huh?
Ready?
He recently started testing the product on bees in his lab.
So we take bees from colonies with high mite levels. We set up numerous cages, some with fungus.
They're finding that the product is killing mites without harming bees.
It's certainly encouraging so far.
And that's not all that mushrooms can do for bees.
Bees have immune systems, just like we do. And these mushrooms, they're like miniature pharmaceutical factories.
Their initial results show that certain forest mushrooms can reduce viruses in bees and help them live longer.
I think I've discovered now that the fungi that are rotting the logs are absolutely critical for the immunological health of the bees. This is a really interesting potential breakthrough in understanding how nature works and how we co-evolve with fungi.
Shepard and Stamets plan to expand both experiments by partnering with commercial beekeepers. Eric Olson was the first to sign up.
I don't have too much hair left. I have pulled my hair out. We just can't seem to get a control on the varroa mite. We've got our fingers crossed.
The future of Western honeybee colonies and the billions of dollars of crops they pollinate may depend on it.
Eric Olson has 35,000 beehives, or he had. He lost 75% of his beehives this year to colony collapse disorder. So now we did that 2 years ago. Here's this fungus that is an entomopathogenic fungus that kills the mites. Also, this fungus kills mites on cannabis. So we are, there's something called green mussel. It's for aphids and thrips. It's off-label. The USDA has approved this fungus because it's non-toxic to non-targeted insects, non-toxic to fish, and non-toxic to humans, other animals. It's been approved now in food handling facilities. It's that safe. It's a sporulating fungus that is extremely effective at controlling mites and chicks and several other types of arthropods. It's called Metarhizium anisipli or Metarhizium brunium. So we put it in the beehive, and the bees consume it and spread it around, and it gets on top of the bees and it infects the mites. So the mites are the vector for the viruses that are really the nail in the coffin of the bees. So we started out in some small experiments at Washington State University in Pullman, Washington. The spread of the deformed wing virus over the past 80 years came from Asia, a classic epidemic that's become a pandemic. It's all over the world now. And the deformed wing virus, every bee in the world that's been analyzed in the past 10 years, according to Dr. Jay Evans, USDA virologist, United States Department of Agriculture virologist, he has not seen a virus-free bee in 10 years. Native bees now have it. When a queen flies, 150 to 200 male drones, which are haploid, by the way, follow the queen and 15 or 20 inseminate her. Kind of kinky. And then the other bees, if they have pollen or honey, they drift into wild bee populations. The wild bees accept them, and they spread the virus. 70 to 80% of pollination benefits that farmers receive come from wild bees, not from the honeybee, Apis mellifera. The problem is wild bees cannot be tracked or measured. When you lose your honeybees, the bees are suddenly gone. You had 50,000 bees one day. On Monday, you have none on Wednesday. And there might be a few dead ones, but they're gone. And so that's what the big mystery. They fly out and they disappear. They don't come back. And it's because of the deformed wing virus, the wings are not able to support the bees. They go on the ground and wasps and ants and things, you know, attack them. So the introduction of varroa mites to native bee population of honeybees leads to a tremendous rise in deformed wing virus. 100% of honeybees now are infected. There's a global pandemic of the deformed wing virus. So in 2016, it's just a few of the articles that have identified the deformed wing virus as the ultimate death knell for the honeybee. When there's more than 7% mites on bees, a population of bees, when the infection, when they have 7% of that population has mites, that's terminal for the population. 7% or more, the colony will not survive to the next year. The honeybees are actually able to keep the varroa mites at bay if they didn't get sick. But because of these viruses, and there's several other ones too, the Lake Sinai virus, the Black Queen Cell virus, the Israeli apiary virus, but it causes the bees to become sick, the malaise. When you're sick, you're not feeding your children as well, you're not cleaning your house as well, you're immunologically challenged, so opportunistic infections can come into play, same too with bees. So we came up with using the mushroom mycelium and creating a form of honey. There's no honey here at all, but it's called mycohoney. And we use this in order to feed the bees. And so we started doing experiments, the first small experiments at Washington State University, 100 bees in a cage. We had different concentrations and we had controls, where it's just sugar water. The majority of beekeepers feed their bees sugar water. 50% by mass of water and sugar together, and they use this to help to give the bees enough sugar. So we started doing some tests. This is a typical arrangement where the sugar water is in these 2-liter containers and feeding the beehives, photographed by Randy Oliver. So the summary of our initial research is as follows. In the birch forest, the red belted polypore goat grows. This is the one that the bears were spreading by scratching trees. Amadou, the one that my hat is made of, that beekeepers use for, that's chaga. Amadou, the one my hat is made of. And then red reishi, which I held up earlier, I've been testing about 20 different species. The results are as following. With the Amadou mushroom versus the deformed wing virus, we have a 1,000-to-1 reduction of the virus within 2 weeks. So how beautiful that our ancestors used Amadou for smoking hives, and now in 2017,
we discover that the amadou reduces the viruses in bees. The red reishi also reduces the deformed wing virus more than 1,000 times. Dr. Jay Evans, who's one of the most renowned virologists in the United States for the USDA, said, I've never seen such strong activity against bee viruses as I ever seen with these extracts. So this is third-party authentication. These are double-blind, placebo-controlled, randomized experiments that are cloaked. And so Jay Evans, who did the analysis, had no idea which samples were the controls and what the treatments were. So chaga and the red reishi is highly active against the black queen cell virus. All queens are infected with these viruses, which means all the brood, all the descendants, are also carrying these viruses forward. The threat to the queen stock in the United States and around the world is extremely serious. And so there is, a plurality, a multiplicity of viruses that are being spread by the varroa mites. So now something very strange happens in my life all the time, it seems, but something very strange happened. Okay, I read this article that came out on P. cumaric acid was absent in the honey from abandoned beehives. So there'd be 400 pounds of honey in some of these beehives, and the bees won't touch it. Well, they analyzed it, and they found that it lacked this polyphenol called P. cumaric acid. And P. cumaric acid controls the cytochrome P450 pathway. It's not that complicated. We all animals use it. You have it primarily in your liver. You've heard that your liver detoxifies. Well, that's because of the cytochrome P450 pathway. With bees, P. cumaric acid is the chemical that activates selectively that detoxification pathway. Without P. cumaric acid, the bees cannot break down toxins. So not only are the bees lacking foraging glands, not only are factory farms putting on trucks to the almond orchards of California, which is unnatural, not only they're exposed to neonicotinoids and glyphosates, but the fact they're exposed to heavy metal, air pollution, all this other stuff, they can't break down these toxins because of peak cumaric acid not being there. Well, I'm not a chemist, but I've seen peak cumaric acid before. It's involved in the delignification of wood by mycelium. And so looking at as wood is broken down, P. cumaric acid is related to vanillic acid. That's why wood smells good. It's vanilla. It's part of the consequence of the mycelium breaking down the wood. This just came out this past year. As it turns out that P. cumaric acid is a potent precursor to Tamiflu. Tamiflu is a multi-billion dollar anti-flu drug approved by the FDA. Most of you are aware of it. It turns out that Tamiflu is made from the star anise that's collected in Afghanistan and elsewhere in the Middle East. Once a year, you can imagine the supply chain issues when you have to harvest once a year and then build enough inventory for Tamiflu. But now we have found, other researchers, not myself, have found that P. cumaric acid comes from mushroom mycelium upon exposure to ultraviolet light. So, an antiviral active against flu viruses that harm humans. P. cumaric acid seems to be really important. Bees who die and the colony collapse, there's no P. cumaric acid because they don't have access to wood. So when we deforest the landscape, we are robbing the bees of mycelium. The mycelium is not there because the wood is not there. And by taking away the menu for the mycelium, we're removing essential nutrients that are critical for bee survival. And then Dr. Steve Shepard, we found that our extracts double the lifespan of bees. So most all bees only live for about 30 days. Highly significant, if you look at the lower bar, that's bees without treatment, the higher bar with treatment, and it turns out that the red-belted polypore, the one that bears are introducing through bear scratches, doubles the lifespan of bees. So humans are so adept at choosing exactly opposite their best interests. By killing the bears, we're removing the entry wounds
that the red-belted polypore can help native as well as domesticated bee stocks. And Dr. Steve Shepard gave us a great quote, "As an entomologist of 39 years, I'm unaware of any reports of materials that extend the lifespan of bees more than this." So we have two solid scientists saying the bee virus is reduced by 500 to 1,000 to 1, and we double the lifespan of bees. So we have partnered with the Bee Friendly campaign. I just got a report back yesterday, the day before yesterday. We started a campaign as for citizen scientists. Many people here have contributed money to the Washington State University Bee Research Program. I just got the report. I had no idea. But we contributed $111,000 in cash to WSU, but the people contributed $2.7 million for bee research. Now, this is when I file patents on this. Let me explain something about patents. None of you here would have an iPhone or a Droid without patents. None of you would have automobiles without patents. Patents are used to incentivize the inventor for novelty. Three tests of a patent: teaches against conventional wisdom, which means I have scientists say that won't work. Great, thank you very much. That teaches against conventional wisdom. Secondly, no prior art. No one's ever published this before or spoken about it. Third is usefulness. Benjamin Franklin could not invent the iPhone because it wasn't useful. So these are three tests of patentability. I filed patents on this. I fully intend to open source them for the commons, but not yet. If I open source it now, Monsanto will take it, and they'll greenwash, and then you know this will never come to market. So it's important that inventors are incentivized and that patents become open source after 17 years. I hope to open source this much more quickly, but we need to have Michael warriors across the planet putting this into implementation as soon as possible. So the extracts are orally active, post-ingestion, past the microbiome, and past the cytochrome P450 pathway. So this is an animal clinical study. Orally ingested bees are animals. We all grew up with Winnie the Pooh. We all knew that bees would build beehives and hollows of rotted logs, and bears would come after the honey. But I gave my first talk on this in front of 800 bee scientists, over 1,000 years of research in this audience. I presented them with this, and I gave them this challenge. If anybody here has ever heard that bees immunologically benefit from mycelium and rotted logs, stand up now. Tell me where, tell me when, give me the citation. And I have to say, I did milk this for several minutes. Come on, there has to be somebody here. Nobody. Hiding in plain sight. The hubris of humans' ego. And I'm a big fan of Google, but I know Google people are here. Hey, you should be open to, you should be sensitive to some criticism from an Earth warrior here. The moonshot. Well, this is a moonshot. How about an Earth shot? How about supporting the ecosystems of Earth, you know, before we go into the moon? All these factors benefit the bees. I wish I was a multi-billionaire because I know that I could save millions of lives, you know, within this lifetime and preserve biodiversity. But I'm on the fringe. And so creating this business has become the vehicle of funding so I don't have to go begging, which is not part of my DNA. When I have to go to other people to ask for money, I feel soiled. I feel cheap. You know, so no longer do I have to do that. We can use our own funds to sponsor our own research. So, we just completed a study in the 532 beehives in the almond orchards of California with these three mushrooms, two reishis, and one amadou. So here is a 3-4-minute movie on the research that we did with 532 beehives. I'm giving my voice a break.
Steve Shepard. I'm a professor of entomology here at Washington State University in the Department of Entomology, and I work on honeybee genetics and evolution. Honeybees are by far the most important pollinators for agriculture. Approximately a third of the crops grown rely on cross-pollination to thrive.
I don't think bees are properly recognized for the economic benefit that they give to society. I think increasingly they will be recognized as bees become more scarce and food prices climb. But here, when these beautiful almond orchards, one of the most bee-dependent crops in the world, and the almond industry knows in particular that without honeybees, crops are greatly hindered. So there's many fruits and berries and nuts that are dependent upon bee pollination.
Over the last decade, honeybee populations worldwide have declined drastically. Beekeepers and scientists have been working to try to find out what's the cause of this decline. One of the leading problems facing beekeepers today is the Varroa mite. These mites attach themselves to bees, feed on their blood, feed on the larvae, and transmit viruses.
Varroa mites are very good at developing resistance to chemical treatments. The beekeeping industry had a couple of compounds that they used pretty extensively originally, and it's really just a matter of time before mites develop resistance to that compound.
Right here is a sick bee. You can see her wings are deformed. This is a symptom of Varroa and a virus called deformed wing virus.
This colony is not going to make it. So even though there are bees here now, this has been destroyed by Varroa. There's all these dead larvae in here that will never become adult bees and never contribute.
There's a tremendous need to develop methods to control Varroa mites that are sustainable and don't rely on the use of chemicals, allowing beekeepers to get off of a chemical treadmill. I became aware a couple of years ago of some work by fungi perfecti and Paul Stamets. They had some fungal extracts, some mushroom extracts, that had antiviral properties. So the idea then became to use mushroom extracts to attempt to control the virus titers.
The extracts we're using are coming from the living tissue of this mushroom when it was alive, called the mycelium. And now we're seeing that these mushrooms actually extend the longevity of bees.
Previous experiments using mycorrhizal fungi put the fungal spores directly in the beehive and had some success in controlling the mites. However, the fungus did not survive well at the higher temperatures, especially in the summertime. So we have a program to select for strains of this mycorrhizal that can withstand higher temperatures. And one of the innovative things that's being done is to actually select for strains of fungus that are more virulent against the mites.
Honeybees are critical to agriculture. They pollinate more than 110 varieties of crops. This orchard that we're standing in is 800 to 1,000 acres, and every single one of those blossoms needs to be fertilized in a timely manner all at once.
This research experiment that we're doing, I think it's the largest beehive experiment ever conducted in the world. 532 beehives testing the effects of these extracts in helping bees survive.
So what we're doing is we are sampling these beehives to check virus levels, and then we're also treating them with mushroom extracts, which is what we're testing here.
So one of the beauties of the fungal extract for controlling the viruses in honeybees is the ease of use for commercial beekeepers. They're used to handling products like this as far as mixing something into their sugar syrup and feeding it to bees. It's very simple to adopt.
My hope is that this research will give us a very important tool in our biological toolkit to help save biodiversity and the ecosystems of this planet. If our ecosystems fail, what do people do for food? And this is fundamental to saving our ecosystems. So I'm hoping that people will recognize mushrooms for the important roles that they play in the ecosystem, of which we're just now beginning to discover, before it's too late.
Now, to put it in perspective, there's a miticide, it's also active against ticks, called Ametraz. Ametraz now is not allowed to be used by beekeepers. Industrial strength Ametraz for killing ticks on cattle has been used at that same concentration by beekeepers. The majority of the commercial beekeepers have been using Ametraz and dunking their beehives, soaking it in Ametraz twice per year. Now, these past 2 years, they're treating 9 times a year. This means the majority of honey that is being marketed today, unfortunately, has these toxins within them. So beekeepers who are doing, have bees up in clear cuts, for instance, where they have not used herbicides or are remote from industrial agriculture, that honey is good honey. But organic beekeepers, you know, are very much struggling because they can't use Ametraz. Ametraz is not legal to be used by beekeepers, but it's off-label because the beekeeping industry has no alternative. Colony collapse is happening all over the world. So we treated the bees, and this is some of our research team, the Washington State University, and then a fungi perfecti. We make 55-gallon drums of these extracts. This is highly scalable, easily deployed. And so I'm going to kind of go backwards a little bit. Directly after 9/11 in 2001, I was approached by the U.S. Department of Defense because of bioterrorism and the concern of weaponizable viruses. I published an article 6 months earlier in HerbalGram summarizing the unique antiviral properties of mushrooms based on the scientific literature. A whopping 1 page long with 2 big photographs, almost nothing. So the BioShield Biodefense program went on. You can look this up. You can Google my name, Stamets, and smallpox, and National Public Radio, NPR. Your interview with me, the deputy director of the FDA, and the head of the BioShield Biodefense program. Of more than 2 million samples submitted, our mushroom extracts were in the top 10 compared to pure pharmaceuticals and being able to reduce viruses that afflict humans. So there's something called bio-guided fractionation. It's the way that traditionally the pharmaceutical industry has isolated out a new drug. They take a plant from the Amazon, they use a solvent that's highly polar, water on the far left, or hexane on the far right, different polarities, they create 2 different fractions. Now they test each fraction, and did that fraction increase in its antimicrobial or antiviral activity or not? If it did, then they go down a decision tree with other solvents that try to isolate one pure molecule. This takes many, many years and hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars, to find a drug, useful molecule that'll make it to market. So, working with the University of Mississippi, the National Center for Natural Products Research, the Government Laboratory of Natural Products, doing bio-guided fractionation using that decision tree that I talked about from an old-growth mushroom called agaricon that grows in the old-growth forest, we found 2 highly active anti-smallpox molecules. We did this. We found novel antiviral, they're called structures, novel APIs, active principal ingredients, sulfuronic and ibukuric acid. After, I think, 1972, immunization against smallpox stopped in this country. So the majority of you are what we call immunologically naive. You have no immune defense. If smallpox comes from the thawing of bodies because of global warming in the Arctic, or a village or a ship was wiped out with smallpox and rodents spread it and bite someone. These pandemics can come back. So those of you who are immunologically naive, the smallpox came back, 10% of you would survive unscathed. 30% of you would die. 30% of you would become blind. 30% of you would be horribly, facially destroyed because of the pox virus and elsewhere around your body. So it's great, okay? We use classic pharmaceutical science to discover two molecules. We now have epidemics that are becoming pandemics. The 1918 flu pandemic killed millions of people around the world. About 2.5% of the population died. We had a 2009 H1N1, a pig flu virus. And then a poultry virus, H7N9, wiped out about 70% of those chickens or turkeys that were infected. In Iowa and Minnesota a few years ago, many of you heard about the euthanasia of millions and millions of chickens. We sent back our mycelium to this organic farm in Iowa, and they fed 50 kilos of chicken of mycelium to 10,000 chickens. It became an oasis of immunity. Those chickens did not have to be euthanized. There's a selectivity index number. I'm closing up here. And it's a measure of how strongly antiviral something is. Anything that is 10 or more is considered to be very active. This is directly a quote from Dr. Earl Kern, who's in charge of the BioShield biodefense program set up after 9/11. We submitted 2,392 samples to the BioShield biodefense program because in my first test, we had activity against pox viruses. And so we got favored status with DOD and NIAID and NIH because we had such strong activity against viruses compared to pure pharmaceutical drugs. So I it's so hard for me to say this, believe me, but I want to express my appreciation to Dick Cheney and George W. Bush for approving the BioShield biodefense program, because this research that I'm showing you is a direct consequence of what we did, you know, in the past. I note there's no applause. Okay, so with agarikon, the red reishi, and chaga, which you see that later we found to be active against the viruses that harm bees, this is a ribavirin, the positive drug control. We're 10 times more active than the pure drugs with a natural extract that's diluted 100 to 1. So we didn't pair it 1 to 1. The extracts were diluted 100 to 1 because they had alcohol in them. So the mycelial extracts were more potent than antiviral drug controls, a pure pharmaceutical. So this engendered us to NIH, as the National Institutes of Health. I collected these strains of these fungi. I have hundreds of strains of fungi. So I'm going to find a superstar. If I've got 100 strains of agarikon, one of them has got to be more stronger than all the others. So we contacted NIH 2 years ago to say, hey, you know, we had great results. I wrote, Dr. Reagan Nally, our employee, wrote NIH. 17 minutes later, the head of NIH virology, Chris Seng, wrote back saying, we'd love to work with you, Paul and Reagan, but we won't do bio-guided fractionation. We don't have the BioShield funding. We don't have the money. We won't isolate out a new molecule from a natural extract. You have to send us a structure, a candidate molecule for us to test. And before we'll test it, we have to make sure that no one's ever tested it before, because we don't want to repeat someone else's work. And cytologically, does it make sense? Does our virologists think that the pharmacokinetics. Will this actually be useful in an animal? So I received a patent on using agarikon against pox viruses, flu viruses, also against herpes. It's very active. And I filed the patent in 2004. Most patents are published, the application is published within a year. 4 years later, not even the application was published. So I got all my patent attorney going, where's my friggin' patent? It's not even up on the application, it's not even up on the homepage. He contacted the patent office, who contacted the Department of Defense, and the Department of Defense quarantined the patent
because of national security. They didn't want terrorists to be aware of an antidote to a virus that they would be weaponizing. It kind of makes sense. So I had to do an intergovernment agency trace, and after 7 years, the patent finally got released by the Department of Defense, and the patent, by unanimity of opinion by 10 patent examiners, was approved. No prior art, teaching against conventional wisdom. How could a natural extract be more potent than an antiviral drug? That doesn't make sense to most virologists, and its usefulness. So then the Fort Detrick of Russia, called Vector, they published an article several years later after my discovery, also authenticating what I had discovered. That's good. I had other virologists, you know, secondarily discover and reaffirm what I discovered initially. Then a Korean group found the same thing. So let's go back to p-cumeric acid. Remember, p-cumeric acid activates the detoxification pathways in bees. It comes from wood. So when we wrote NIH to say we have 100 strains of agarikon, we want to test, they said, no, you have to send in a pure molecule. I'm not a chemist. Good news, bad news. We love working with you, Paul. You send us a new structure, a new molecule, we'll decide whether we want to test it. So I'm going, oh, what do I do? And I have this research on bees. P-cumeric acid comes from wood. Well, why don't I test that? So I look at the delignification pathways in the literature, p-cumeric acid, cinnamic acid, vanillic acid, smells like vanilla. So I submitted 20 molecules that were approved by NIH virology as pure structures, not doing bio-guided fractionation, doing a stoner's dream come true. I used the best of scientific methods, I guessed. Now, there's more than 200,000 molecules that make up a mushroom. So the selection criteria takes a long time. Again, bio-guided fractionation, I did not do that. I submitted the 20 samples, and this is direct from the NIH virology. You can't really see it. But 5 molecules were highly active against HPV. The human papillomavirus, unfortunately, the majority of women in this audience have it right now. 70% of sexually active women have it. 50% of men, causes cervical cancer, uterine cancer, esophageal cancer, in men in particular. It is a ticking time bomb. It's a sinister virus because it doesn't present itself for many years. So this is a huge health crisis that we have on the near event horizon. Something that's very important for all of you to know. So it turns out that 5 of these turned out to be highly, there was no anti-HPV drug out there. There's nothing that's active. The selectivity index of cidofovir is 12. Ours are in the hundreds. So these molecules that the wood is decomposing by the mycelium turn out to be highly antiviral. So we now have antivirals that are active against herpes, flu, the norovirus, hepatitis, pox, as well as several other viruses, more potent than the positive drug controls. So I present to you a mycofactorial equation for a paradigm shift. All these things that I've told you, from the time that I saw bees in my garden, to seeing bear scratches on trees, to work with USDA and WSU, has led to this mycofactorial equation. Antivirals from mushroom extracts are active against pox, flu, herpes viruses. Bees are attracted to mycelium. Bear scratches trees to introduce polypores. Metarhizium infects varroa mites. Fungal p-cumeric acid activates detoxification pathways. Polypore mushrooms extract reduce bee viruses. And the molecules related to p-cumeric acid reduce viruses that harm humans. So, myco extracts also limit the disease transmission by insects to plants. This is truly paradigm shifting. Bees are animals. Pigs are animals, birds are animals, humans are animals. These extracts are reducing all those viruses, again, that afflict multiple animals, but moreover, the first antiviral effect of a mushroom ever discovered is the Amadou mushroom against the tobacco mosaic virus, which causes curly leaf in all sorts of plants and reduces yields in farming agriculture all over the world. The fact that these same extracts that we can treat to aphids and put into honeybee feeders and hummingbird feeders and all sorts of different presentations, foliar sprays, we can limit the viral pandemics that not only afflict animals, but also afflict plants. The nexus point is these wood decomposing fungi. I think this is huge. So what is next? You tell me. This is the beginning. By reinvesting in the intelligence of nature, we are coming up with solutions that will protect our children's futures. Let's become bee mushroomed. Scientists across disciplines need to work together. Mycodiversity is our biosecurity. Understanding that we are intimately woven within the fabric of mycelium, from an evolutionary point of view, from a habitat point of view, and that these animals have selectively partnered with fungi over the millennia, over millions of years, and for good reason. Humans, trees, bears, mushrooms, the birds, the bees, all terrestrial organisms have evolved to be interconnected with the mycelial web of life. Within mycelium is Earth's natural internet. The way of the future is to follow the path of mycelium. And I want to introduce you to a new bumper sticker. Let's celebrate decomposition. Let it rot. And so I want to introduce you to my multi-generational goal is to enter into the mycoverse. I want to create a platform of knowledge. I want to create institutes of mycological training centers all over the world. I want to decentralize this so there's nexus points of knowledge distributed like the mycelial archetype in every country, networking with indigenous peoples, with permaculture experts, with industrial agriculture, and with as many people as possible so we can all work together, because we will always exist together forever within the micromolecular matrix. And I want to thank some of the supporters, Lee and Ju Stein, the Whittier Foundation, our teammates at Starship FP, our company, Louis Schwarzberg, Dusty Yao, my partner, and my older brother John, and my mom. So, folks, thank you very much.